and Commerce and Consumer Protection will come to order. And this is a discussion only, an informational kind of hearing, talking about the impact of federal health insurance reform plan on our MCHA program in Minnesota, our Comprehensive Health Association program, our high-risk health insurance pool, and a very important issue always of interest in the legislature, and something I think we were the first in the country to have this high-risk pool, and I think it's one of the largest and strongest, although we all know that we have funding issues year to year. Some of our members, I think that everybody who's missing is either in a committee or in a conference committee, so with that, we're going to go ahead, and Commissioner Johnson-Regala, I appreciate that you're here again today, and I don't know if anybody wanted to say anything before you started. Anybody? And welcome Senator Berglund to the table as well. Welcome. Good morning again.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Manny Munson-Regala, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. I can figure out how to. Here we go. I'm going to walk through the federal bill, how it addresses high-risk pools. I'm going to talk about sort of the decision-making process the governor engaged in. Then I'll finish with the likely impact on Minnesotans, with a significant caveat that HHS is still writing the regs for the high-risk pool. So we're going to have more information for you as we go along, but I will give you an up-to-date sense of where we are with respect to the federal high-risk pool. Section 1101 of PAPACA, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, created a temporary high-risk pool for uninsured individuals with pre-existing conditions. This temporary pool was slated to end in 2014 when the exchanges will open. At that point, then, the thought was the people in that high-risk pool would transition to the exchange. The pool is intended to be funded by premiums paid by the enrollees and by a one-time $5 billion allocation. And that $5 billion is not per year. It is for the full life of the program. The estimated share, and this comes from HHS's best estimate of the initial allocation, was Minnesota was going to get $68 million, again, over the length of the entire program, the 3.5 years that the pool was going to be up.
Commissioner, how did – I mean, I know there's probably some obvious rationale for that, but what – how did you come up with that figure, Joyce?
The $68 million they came up with was based on, as we understand it, an allocation formula similar to the CHIP funding formula.
Okay.
Had we gone with a straight population approach, I think the number would have been closer to $50 million. So I think they looked at some of our ability to reach up – to do some outreach relative to uninsured populations, so we got some benefit for that. But I'm not really sure. We just know we came up with a better number than we thought we'd originally come up with. The eligibility requirements for the high-risk pool need to be a citizen or a national of the United States or lawfully present. The second bullet, and this is the one that gave us a little bit of heartburn, not have been covered under credible coverage as defined under Section 2701, C1 of the Public Health Service Act for the previous 6 months before applying for coverage. We asked, did that mean if you were currently covered by the pool, you were barred then from accessing this new pool? And the answer was yes. Existing enrollees would have to drop coverage under MCHA in order to be eligible for the high-risk pool.
And, Commissioner, that's the answer?
That was their answer, yes.
And
I'm sorry.
It ends there. That's how it works. I mean, that's really an interesting. How many states have a high risk pool?
Roughly 31, I believe.
So everybody in 31 states would be somehow affected that way. I mean, it would be affected that way.
Correct.
Senator Olson, do you have something?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to say, you know, we've had to do this in other situations too, where if you have when we're looking at paying a benefit, for For one thing, the health plans, when we've made some changes, have not wanted everybody to just, you know, jump ship off their plan. But in a situation like this where it's MSHA, I'm imagining that since this is thought to that it's going to be a lower premium and it's going to be better coverage, that essentially you'd have a whole lot more people going into this plan if you didn't have that six-month waiting period. I'm guessing that that was some of the thought that went into this, because otherwise why would anyone want to be in the old MSHA plan if you can get better coverage for less money? So, you know, the cost would probably have been a lot higher to cover all those people. But this way, I think we have a choice between people who would prefer one over the other. There are pluses and minuses depending on which way you go. Now, that's I see a couple of people here shaking their head, but that's the way it was presented to the to our committee initially in Health and Human Services, that these were two separate plans and that one had, that the federal plan was going to have lower cost and better benefits, but had the disadvantage of the six-month waiting period.
So, I mean, that's a real conundrum. I mean, because the people who really need it, I mean, maybe not everybody who really needs it is in MCHA, but the people who are in there need to be in there, and yet would have to go without insurance for 6 months to go in there, to be in this lower cost or whatever. Commissioner, will it run concurrently? I mean, you can be in one or the other. Is that the idea?
Correct, Madam Chair. And I'll go through the benefit differences in a later slide so you get a sense. But, Senator Olson, I think one of our challenges is we may not have a true apples-to-apples comparison here. As I go through the benefit and premium differences, you'll see that for certain individuals, it's possible the MCHA plan might be a better deal for them, depending on what type of deductible they get, what age band they're in. So I'll walk through those differences in my slides. The last bullet in terms of eligibility requirements is they had to have a pre-existing condition as determined in a manner consistent with guidance issued by the Secretary. As I mentioned earlier, the Secretary is still working on that guidance. HHS has indicated some degree of flexibility in working with the states, particularly the states that are going to administer the program themselves, on eligibility requirements, pre-existing conditions. The one area they've indicated they have no flexibility on is this credible coverage one, the six-month bar. I know a number of states have run some ideas past them on maybe crediting, not converting participation in an existing pool as not really being credible coverage, right. And HHS pretty much said, you can float that, we're going to tell you, we're not likely to receive that as being consistent with what the law allows us to do.
Very interesting. Senator Olson, did you have something?
Well, I was only going to say, Madam Chair, that even though it's expensive, MSHA, for people who are in it right now, you know, they do have coverage.
Yes.
I would certainly think that for new people coming in, or there's a lot of people that don't pick up MSHA because they can't afford it, where this may, for those people, be a more affordable option. It seems like we would not want to turn down $68 million of federal money, that we would at least want to make some this option available for the people who would qualify for it, because then, you know, we end up subsidizing MSHA as well as private taxpayer or private insurance policy holders end up subsidizing MSHA. So if we can get some relief off tax dollars and private premiums by making sure that this option is available for people in Minnesota who would qualify, even though it may not be 100% ideal, I would think we'd want to do that.
And Madam Chair,
yes,
Senator Olson, Senator Olson, you're correct. And in fact, we don't lose the money, no matter which way the governor decided. The governor's decision was not do we take the money or not. It was who administers that money. So, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit in the slides. As you know, the governor opted not to administer the fund. But the fact is that money is still available for Minnesotans to access. So we still get the benefits without the associated risk of running the fund ourselves. But let me cover. So here are the options the states could have considered. One, they could have operated a new high-risk pool along a current state pool, and they could have established a new high-risk pool for states that don't have one. And like I said, there are roughly 20 states that did not have a high-risk pool. They can build upon other existing coverage programs, decided to cover high-risk individuals in states with guaranteed issue. They could have done some work there, for example. They can contract with a current HIPAA carrier of last resort or other carrier to provide subsidized coverage for the eligible population, or, as the governor opted to do nothing, in which case HHS would carry out a coverage program in their state. And I can't emphasize that enough. I think there's some confusion that the governor's decision meant we don't get the money. No, the money is still accessible for Minnesotans.
Okay. In that amount, that our proportion or whatever?
Yes, but I will explain there may be some tweaks to that down the road.
Okay.
All right, so Secretary Sebelius asked the governors or in states with elected insurance commissioners, their commissioners for the state's intentions. I provided a copy of the secretary's letter for you. We looked at the what the federal pool was going to offer versus current MCHA. Federal pool has to be at an actual value of at least 65% of total allowed costs. We're at 63%. The out-of-pocket limit had to be no greater in the federal pool than the applicable amount for high-deductible health plans, roughly $59.50 per individual. Our out-of-pocket limit is $3,000, except for the $5,000 and $10,000 deductible plans, which will pay in MCHA 100% after satisfaction of deductible. No pre-existing condition exclusions in the federal pool. Pre-existing condition exclusion waived for HIPAA-eligible individuals in our pool. I know Ms. Gruber's here, too, so if we have additional questions on how MCHA administers the current pool, I'm sure she'd be glad to answer that.
Yes, I expect that Ms. Gruber will come up here at some point.
On the premium side, and this is where I think this gave some states, and certainly our state, some degree of heartburn, premiums must not exceed 100% of the standard non-group rate in the federal pool. Premiums must be under our law, between 101% and 125% of the weighted average of the rates charged. The current above-market rate in MCHA right now is 120%. It will be moving to 122%. MCHA just did some rate filings looking to get to the 122%. I will note that even at 122%, they're running an annual deficit about $130 million a year. So, and as you know, the deficit for MCHA is covered by assessments on the plans who write the standard insurance, fully insured market. That would be your individuals, your small group. That, in turn, then gets added to the premiums that those purchasers, the small businesses, the individuals pay. Under the federal pool, and this is where, to get to your point, Senator Olson, there may be some advantages, depending on how old you are, to buying an MCHA plan. The new plans may not, under the federal pool, have an age rating greater than 4-1. MCHA's current age rating cap is 3-1.
But, Mr.
All right, so we reached out to MCHA because obviously if we were going to do this, they were going to be our likely partner to administer this program. We asked them to consider, would they want to participate in the plan? And after some fairly extensive deliberation on their part, a number of board meetings, they came back and told the governor they did not wish to administer the program. And I've attached a copy of their first letter to you. I'm just going to cover it in high-level bullets. First, there's a short time frame to implement. The expectation is that they're going to start enrolling people by July 1st. We're now hearing that my guess is they will have staggered enrollment dates by states depending on the nature of, is it going to be a federal program or a state program? Interestingly enough, I suspect in some states, had they opted to go with the federal choice, they could enroll people quicker because some states are going to require statutory changes in order to administer a new high-risk pool. Here, the funding would be inadequate. Again, we mentioned that the feds estimate $68 million for Minnesota for the entire program. Current pool deficit's around $130 million a year.
Our current Minnesota pool.
There was a concern, what happens if when the money runs out? Fear that MCHA would be held liable for shortages related to the previous point. Their TPA did not want to administer the program. The federal pool created an inequitable landscape, and that was a big concern of the MCHA board, that they've taken care of their 27,000, 30,000 current enrollees. Those folks have worked hard to pay the 120, now 122% of premium. And I will tell you, when we get letters from current enrollees, because MCHA has to do a public hearing on whenever they do a rate filing, the most common refrain the commissioner gets is, this is too much. We pay too much for this coverage. And you know, even capped at 120% of standard.
And the TPA, I mean, every member knows, third-party administrator.
I'm sorry, yes. Yeah,
no, I just...
Yes, if I start lapsing into jargon, please throw a flag at me. There was a concern about the new federal pool's ability to freeze enrollment and transition federal pool members into the new exchanges. And they were concerned, what happens with, all right, so you have one of these new enrollees. They get a significant claim in December 2013. Who's on the hook for that claim once the exchanges come up and running? So those are the concerns they raised with us. I would characterize it as a pretty much polite hell no. So we pushed back hard and said, are you sure you're really saying hell no? Are you saying no with conditions? They had a second emergency board meeting, and they provided the second letter which you have, which is to say, okay, if the governor wants to proceed, we will only do so under these terms. So the options we gave the governor in terms of, here's the landscape here of the kind of decision-making process you have to make. As you know, the governor last Friday opted not to administer the pool. That will mean, as I mentioned, HHS will administer the pool for Minnesotans. The money doesn't disappear. The money is still going to be there, useful for Minnesotans. In his letter, the governor cited the financial wish of the state, and he references CMS's actuarial own study on the likelihood of exhaustion of the funds prior to 2014. The actuary for CMS said the pool is going to have to do a couple of things. It will either have to cap enrollment, raise premium, or lower benefits. Those are the decisions it has to make because, and I'll back up a little bit here, there's a National Association of the High-Risk Pools, NASCHIP, another acronym. They had projected that you could do high-risk pools for the country, and I think Ms. Gruber can confirm this, if you had allocated $5 billion a year. So $5 billion for 3.5 years gave some of the pools heartburn. The governor has been joined in this decision by 17 other states for sure. There are two other states whose answers were equivocal. It's not really clear if they said yes or no. So we're looking for clarity from them. 30 or so states are, and the District of Columbia are going to proceed with administering some version of the pool themselves. HHS, we've been engaged in conversations with HHS on what does this mean for Minnesotans. They will administer the federal pool for Minnesota. Once we get information from them on enrollment procedure, who do they contact, we'll provide that information in a couple of different venues, a couple of different places. In the meantime, MCHIL will continue to serve existing members and individuals who are neither eligible or interested in the federal plan. And as I mentioned, Senator Olson, this is going to be, particularly if you're an older individual, it may be cheaper for you to access MCHIL even at the 120%. And we're going to work with both MCHIL and the higher and HHS to ensure fair and equitable treatment of Minnesotans.
Commissioner, CMS, can you?
Oh, I'm sorry, Center for Medicaid Services.
Okay, for Medicaid Services.
And I apologize, Madam Chair, they've set up a new Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight under the Health and Human Services Department. It is headed by Director Jay Angoff, A-N-G-O-F-F. He's a former commissioner from the state of Missouri. They recently just named another deputy director for that office, Stephen Larson. I think that's L-A-R-S-E-N, former commissioner from Maryland. Secretary Sebelius, as some of you know, was the former insurance commissioner from Kansas, former governor of Kansas, recruiting a number of her former colleagues to help her with the insurance reform pieces that HHS is charged with dealing with, including the high-risk pool. A gentleman by the name of Tony Culotta, C-U-L-O-T-T-A, in charge of just the high-risk pool piece. He's a longtime HHS employee. I think he's been there for 25 years. It's possible that some of our Medicaid folks may have run into Mr. Culotta before. but he's right now in the process of both reviewing the state contract applications. Because, let me back up. If a state agreed to administer the program, that was no guarantee they were actually going to end up administering the program. What they had to tell the HHS on Friday was, we'll start a contract negotiation process with you. So he's reviewing those contract proposals, and then he's looking to determine how he's going to administer, or how HHS is going to administer the federal pool, the roughly 20 states that opted to let HHS administer the federal pool.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, broad questions. Of these other states, you said roughly 19 have decided not to do this and 33 have. Where those decisions have been made by other states, have they been made only by the executive branch, or have they been made sometimes by the legislative branch? So that's one question I have, is who's been making that decision in other states? And then the other question is, of the 33 who have decided to do this at the state level, I mean, you've presented us with all the reasons why the governor decided not to do this. Could you give us some of the reasons why other states have decided that they did decide to do this? It sounds like, you know, almost twice as many decided they do want to do this. And why would they do that with all the negative things out there that you've been talking about?
Commissioner.
Chair, Senator Olson. First question with respect to who's made the decision. As I know, and I will apologize, I haven't looked at all the letters. I've just seen a few of them. First, Secretary Sebelius asked the executive branch in all the states to make the call for those states.
Okay.
So the responses have come back, as I understand it, from governors or, in cases with elected insurance commissioners, from elected insurance commissioners. Now, in the states that have opted to participate in the program, some of them have had legislative input to implement the governor's decision. I don't know what interaction their governor's office had with their legislature on collaboratively coming up with that decision, but that's been my sense of the legislative involvement in the states that opted to opt in. Now, with respect to why states chose to participate, again, I don't know all the reasons, but from the letters I have seen, they are all over the place. Some of them have never had a high-risk pool before. They look at this as a good opportunity to learn about how you do a high-risk pool. Some of them believe that they have an existing guaranteed issue approach to doing this. Some of them thought that, you know, they could get it up and running faster than HHS would be able to get it up and running. Some of them wanted to be in control of the process. So it's kind of a mix of different reasons for making the decision. I know the states that opted out tend to uniformly cite the financial risk and the equity issues associated with the difference. And I will say the equity issues for some states are fairly significant. We cap our top-end premium at 125% of standard. In other states, it's up to 200% of standard. So for those states, the inequity associated between existing high-risk pool members current ones, it's a little more challenging for them. I think in some respects, one of our little challenges in Minnesota is because we have a fairly successful program, I believe at this point we have the largest high-risk pool program in the country. The opportunity to administer a different program for a relatively small number of people. By relatively small, I should say, we did an estimate based on what we expected likely take-up rate was and likely enrollment that we would have to cap it at. We were thinking between 1,000 to 2,000 people for the life of the federal program. Now, HHS may opt to go a different direction. They may choose, for example, not to cap enrollment. I find it hard to believe they're going to run out of money pretty quick.
Senator Olson and then Senator Berglund would
okay.
like to talk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say I'm having a hard time understanding the equity issue, because it seems to me if we're talking about equity for the insured person, I think that's what you're talking about. unless we're talking about equity for the plans, and I'm not really, I think you're talking about the insured person. It just seems to me that for most of these people, there may be a few people on the high end, and you'd have to multiply the premium times 122% compared to 100% and then compare the 3 to 4 times, I suppose, to figure out if which way is better. But for the vast majority of people who haven't had insurance for 6 months, this is going to be a more affordable plan, it sounds like. And I would think that the people who can least afford to pay are the ones who would be going without coverage for 6 months simply because they can't afford it. Now would come along a more affordable option for them. And so it seems to me that trying to make a lower-cost insurance product available for people who can't afford the higher cost, that's why they've probably been waiting and going without coverage, seems to me not to be unfair or inequitable. You know, I understand anyone else might say, well, how come, why do I have to pay more? But they have the advantage of having to have coverage all that time. So anyway, that's how I would view it, is that this is and I hope it's not going to take longer to get into the federal program than what some states end up being able to have offered for people to be able to take advantage of that. I don't know how long it's going to take.
Commissioner, I mean, individuals who are not currently in MCHA will be able to get into this plan administered by HHS, right?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Deputy Director, my concern is that we take full advantage of the money that is going to be available to cover uninsurable individuals, because I believe that having people from Minnesota in this high-risk pool is going to reduce the burden on our current MSHA pool and thereby reduce the burden on the assessments that have to be paid to support our current MSHA pool. And I don't know how many new people come into the MSHA pool per year, but undoubtedly there are new people every year that come into the pool. You know, once in a while there's probably somebody that gets out of it, we hope. But when new people come in, if they are eligible for this federal pool, we would want them to go into it. And is there going to be a mechanism to counsel people so that they would know which option is better for them or which option they're eligible for or which option they should be thinking about when they make a decision where to enroll?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, we concur with you that folks who go to the high-risk pool, the federal pool, will take pressure off MCHA. So that was a given. I think the question was whether that could still be accomplished without us taking on the risk of administering the program. But to get to your point about the providing folks the information about the options, HHS just issued a post reg on Friday with respect to the creation of their internet portal that will include, among other things, information about the standard market and the high-risk pool options. So I would assume that they're going to build into that portal some information about both the federal program and the existing state program. And, in fact, they'll probably be reaching out to us pretty soon about feeding that information to them. Interagency working group that's going to be focusing on implementation. Their communication subgroup is going to be working with DHS, Health, and us to get that information to HHS so that portal is as accurate about Minnesota's marketplace as possible. So that's number one.
That's not fair.
Number two, if you recall, there's $30 million roughly, $30 million for consumer outreach in the bill. We don't have the regs on how states apply for that money yet, but we're going to, once we get those regs, and we believe existing state agencies can apply for those regs, we'll be able to use that to do that kind of thing, navigation, education, giving folks the options. For some folks, they may disagree with our recommendation, but I think we'll at least be able to lay out for them the range of options. I mean, Ms. Gruber can expand on this, but one of the interesting things I learned was there are options that are cheaper for existing MCHA members that they would be eligible for than the current plan they're paying for. But for them, the fact that MCHA is guaranteed issue and they can't be non-renewed is a big deal. So that's why they haven't opted, to your point, to leave MCHA and go purchase a private plan. So we might provide them all the options, and they may still conclude they'd rather stay with MCHA, which is, by the way, one of those interesting things you guys are going to have to wrestle with 2013. There's a grandfathering language in the federal bill. Does it apply to folks? Which means if you're in an existing plan, you like your existing plan, you can stay in your existing plan. We're not sure yet. Does it apply to members of existing high-risk pool plans? So one of the thoughts that the board was thinking, well, if guaranteed issue passes in the federal bill, then you don't need MCHA. We're not sure we know that for a fact. I think we hope to give you more guidance as we get closer to 2014. But that might be one of those issues on grandfathering, which is going to be a very thorny topic to work through, that I think we're going to have to give you some.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I guess I always thought you had to be uninsurable to get into the MCHA pool and to stay in the pool. If you can just choose to be in there when we have financing difficulties and what some would consider an inequitable financing mechanism, we probably should be looking at that again. But my assumption is that if there's guaranteed issue in 2014, that the people in MCHA would be able to go out and get a private policy, and they would be subsidized if their income allowed it through the insurance exchange, and that would be a more appropriate way for them to get their coverage than through an MCHA pool that is financed on the backs of small businesses and individuals.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, you would think that would be the case. I guess Ms. Gruber can explain a little bit more, but that was my surprise, too, to learn that there are some folks that could do better in the private market that really would prefer staying in MCHA. Part of it is, for lack of a better word, inertia. You know the folks you're dealing with. You know how the process works. You're used to writing your check. You develop some, perversely, brand loyalty, I guess,
to the
plan you're in.
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner, I just have to say that if they're able to do that, that is a small miracle, because the MCHA coverage isn't really very good, and it is very expensive. You know, my daughter was in MCHA for a while, and she wasn't even 21 years old yet, and we were paying $300 a month for her coverage, which was 80-20, $500 deductible. And so, you know, we almost got nothing ever paid for. I mean, you know, she wasn't sick. It was a previous condition that caused her to be denied coverage. It was very, very expensive coverage. She now has adequate coverage that covers her needs for $130 a month.
Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I could share stories, too, that I've heard from my constituents. I know that it's supposed to be 122% of premiums, but how exactly they come up with these numbers, there are other factors they can be weighting when they're doing that comparison. It becomes very, very expensive for small business owners. Without going into that kind of thing, I guess just to follow up on Senator Berglund's point and the whole purpose behind MCHA, I guess it would be for the legislature to decide whether we really want to allow that to continue if it isn't necessary or needed simply because of reasons like inertia. It would seem to me that we would want to be proactive in perhaps requirements, and maybe they should come sooner rather than later to make sure that people's cases are evaluated and that they are directed to the most appropriate insurance coverage, and that maybe we want to make that a legal requirement as going forward when there are going to be these options to make sure that people are being given the best choice.
Madam Chair, yes, Senator Olson, that absolutely makes sense. I think the challenge for us will be, to some extent, your folks' choices or policy options are going to be constrained by what HHS promulgates in the way of guidance on the grandfathering piece. To the extent I didn't make that clear, I apologize. The point I was trying to make with Senator Berglund is that one of the questions you're going to have to address is, this is admittedly a what if, but what if the grandfathering provisions in the bill were interpreted in such a way as to apply to existing MHA members? If that happens, then there are some challenges then with requiring, since the federal law allows them to stay with an existing plan and be renewed on an existing plan, with the only caveat being you can change the pricing based on medical costs and claims. What happens if the grandfathering provisions apply to MHA? That's where I'm trying to say some of your options may be constrained. I'm not suggesting that your direction isn't the right way to go. I think we would concur. We want to get folks to the best plan available for them. We might have limits on our ability to do that.
Ms. Gruber, did you want to
thank you, Madam
address
Chair.
Any of the comments?
I sure would. Lynn Gruber, President of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. First of all, there are 35 risk pools in the country. One of them, Florida, has been frozen for years, a very political mess down there in terms of such a big state. And they
frozen, no new members.
No new members, and that's been that way for many, many, many years. But I wanted to get back to Senator Olson's and Senator Berglund's perception that people are locked into MCHA. They are not. And the group that Deputy Commissioner Munson-Regala was really speaking to are our Medicare folks that are clinging to MCHA. We, every single year, more than once a year, we notify all of our members, let's take the Medicare people first, that they have an option to go to the private market, and we highly encourage them to go. We have about 700 people left. We started off a few years ago with almost 4,000 Medicare supplement members. We're now down to 789, something like that. Many of these folks have end-stage renal disease, and that is one of the diseases that apparently can be denied in the private market. So the majority of these folks are either have some type of drug regimen that they do not want to leave, or their end-stage renal disease. But I assure you, we do notify them, and we urge them to go to the private market, and we direct them to the resources they can find because we know they're better off there. It's, you know, lower price, and sometimes you can get more options, eyeglasses, hearing aids, things like that. So I think that's what you're really referring to. The other group, and this comes back, I think, to Senator Berglund or the legislator's idea, is to at least once a year notify all members that have had few claims in the last 2 years that they may be well enough to be back in the private market. So we religiously do that. Every year when the premium rates are approved, about this time of year in May, we send out a letter. We identify the people that have had low claims, and we encourage them to look to the private market. So we are constantly doing that because we are well aware that, you know, the price of insurance in MCHA is very difficult for some of our members to make. And third, we have been working with the federal government since 2002 so that we have a small federal grant program that the risk pools work to get that allows us to put together a premium subsidy program. And we've been able to do this for the last, well, whenever we get funding. And the funding is about to be hopefully renewed. But the money isn't very much. For instance, the last time we got money was just this past year, $4 million. About three of it goes to help us, goes toward the losses, and $1.5 million goes toward the premium subsidy program. So about 2,800 members of lower income were helped last year, and we're going to do the same thing this year. So we're well aware of, you know, the cost of coverage and that we want our members not to stay with us if they don't have to, but really to go to the private market. And then coming back to the beginning of the program, how did the number $68 million, how was that decided? It's my understanding that the formula was the size of the state's uninsured rate, and the cost of health care in your state. So, you know, we get dinged because we don't have a real high uninsured rate, and we are pretty good on cost of care. And then, of course, the size, we're small. We're a small state. So, for instance, we're getting $68 million. The state of California is getting $800 million. Because they're big, because they have a big uninsured rate. So that's how the allocation plays out.
And Madam Chair, that actually reminds me, the one thing that the members need to understand is HHS, again, they haven't written regs, so this is where they're giving us directionally where they intend to go. They said the 68 this year is their first year snapshot guess of what amount our state would have access to over the life of the program. They also made it clear that after the first year of the program, they'll reassess the take-up rates from the different states, the loss experience, all of those factors to determine should there be reallocations of that funding. So, for example, and I have to assume they're going to go in this direction, but they haven't committed to that. Let's say they cap enrollment in each state at based on what they believe is likely to be sustained by the initial allocation. Our back of the envelope, or Scrooge's back of the envelope, was roughly 2,000 people. So let's say we will cap Minnesota at 2,000 enrollees in the federal program. And let's say after year one, we only enroll 1,000. For whatever reason, it's not nearly as attractive a program as they anticipated. And a state like Texas over-enrolled or has a waiting list. They may conclude in those circumstances to reallocate some of the dollars to states where there's a perceived need, or vice versa. Let's say we blow through our 2,000 and we have a wait list of another 1,000. They may reallocate dollars from other states that aren't using the money to Minnesota. So what we understand from HHS is that initial allocation is just a starting point to get a sense of theoretically what's the state going to have to work with, but there is going to be some reallocation in the course of the program, and they're charged with not running this against a deficit. So, which is why I think they're going to probably start with capping enrollment and then see after the first year how much need there is.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Munson-Ragala, I'm just wondering then, wouldn't it be in the advantage of a state to be aggressive about getting people enrolled in this program early and make sure that everyone has the information? Otherwise, we're likely to lose funds to other states that have been more aggressive.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that's correct. I think that we can still do that, though, without being in charge of the program ourselves. I mean, we will certainly work with, MCHS is going to be steering people that direction. We're going to be steering people that direction to at least look there first. If you want to think of it in terms of sort of triaging or a filter, if you're an uninsured individual who's been uninsured for 6 months and you can afford the premium, which is the first bogey you got to get past, and you got to pay 100% of standard, then we're going to say, look into the federal pool first and apply there. Now, this is why MCHS still needs to stick around. If they don't get enrolled in the federal pool, then they are going to be likely eligible for MCHS. Mm-hmm. So now the challenge will be, this is going to be the tough one if you're one of those people. You can then opt, should I be on a wait list for this federal pool, or do I sign up with MCHS and therefore fall into no longer eligible for the federal pool? That'll be the tough call for some folks that first year, right? So I think those are the things we're trying to wrestle with in terms of the unknowns or known unknowns, how this is going to play out. There are going to be folks who will want to access the federal pool. Depending on how many people do express interest or want to do it, maybe it'll be oversubscribed. Maybe it'll be undersubscribed. We don't know the answer to that yet.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we were going to look at just overall the whole state and decided that we wanted to maximize, as Senator Berglund has said, the receipt of federal money for our health care, for providing health care for our citizens, what would, from 30,000 feet, could the legislature do to accomplish that?
With respect to the high-risk pool or to grant opportunities in general?
With respect to the whole welfare or health care reform.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, there are a number of grant opportunities in the federal bill, a number of funding opportunities related to Medicare expansion, for example. I know that Mr. Osberg has had that conversation with some of the members in other panels. Until we get language from HHS, it's hard for us on some of the grant opportunities, for example, it's hard for us to give you guidance on which grant opportunities both track with directionally where you guys are at on healthcare reform, on wellness, on quality measurements, on transparency, or where there are areas we're already doing already. So to answer your question, what we hope to give you guys by this fall, or I shouldn't say hope, that is our objective, is to give you a list of all the options and decisions you will have to make in the next legislative session, and more than likely for several legislative sessions, because this bill will play out over, the federal reform will play out over 10 years.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Ms. Gruber, my concern about this federal portal is that people aren't going to know about it. It's a new thing, and they aren't going to go looking there. So that's why I'm concerned that when people contact your organization, that they get this information so that they can get into the federal pool, if that would be their desire and it would be the best opportunity for them and actually for us.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I couldn't agree with you more. So we will be working with customer service through Medica, giving them a script as to, you know, kind of screening these people to see which pool they're supposed to be in. We'll have information on our website. The NASCHIP website is getting more well-known, which is the organization of all the risk pools in the country. So I hear what you're saying. Absolutely. We want to get people to the right pool. My goodness, if you can get a premium, you know, at market, and we're not sure what the benefits are going to be yet. We haven't heard what the benefits are going to be. That's why we can't say they're going to be a lot richer than ours. EMCHA has very rich benefits, but we don't know what the benefits are yet. But we definitely want to see people get into the right pool. There's no question about that. I understand that whatever organization does administer the new pool has to use some of that allocation money to put out a marketing program and things like that. But I think it's going to have to be a, you know, full court press with all of the health departments that we have, you know, health, DHS, Commerce, and EMCHA, knowing the information so that wherever they go, they're going to get the same message. Here are the rules for you to get into, you know, the federal risk pool. Here's the rule to get into the MCHA pool, the state pool. Couldn't agree with you more.
Madam Chair, and just for your information, Ms. Gruber, my daughter never got a letter from EMCHA about getting into private insurance. The only letter she ever got when she complained about her premiums and when they were going up was a letter suggesting she take a higher deductible.
Well, I don't know how long your daughter was in the pool. Like I said before, those...
Almost 5 years.
Well, she must have had some claims, Senator, or she would have been generated one of the letters.
OBGYN claims.
Well, claims are claims. I mean...
I mean, there was hardly anything paid out for her.
Well, Senator, EMCHA receives people. We don't, you know, reject them. So maybe the issue is in, you know, the underwriting standards that are allowed to go on in the state. It's, you know, we don't set those standards. So you said, I'm not sure why she had to go to MCHA. I don't know either. And that was a rejection from some company that is in the private market. So what I'm saying is we don't make that rule. We take care of the people when they get to us. We try to do the best we can. The $500 deductible, you know, we had a range of deductibles. She chose that one. So she did have a high premium at her age because that is the highest price premium. The more you're willing to pay yourself, the lower your premium is going to be.
Well, if she would have, Madam Chair and Ms. Goober, if she would have taken a higher deductible, she might as well not have had insurance.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Goober, these kinds of concerns are exactly why I had a bill introduced that would allow an additional consumer member on your board. And because one I'd heard a lot of concerns from someone in my district who had been the consumer representative on your board about how decisions were made and their impact on consumers. And I had some other members representing insurance plans, or one of them at least was a member on your board, in my office literally yelling at me because of that bill. So I just want to highlight for you that there are some real concerns about how these kinds of decisions are made and the impact they have on people because of the expense, and where there are some other alternatives. I think we want to make sure, as Senator Berglund said, that people at least know about them. And I think there should be an evaluation done. And actually, I think we should have a state requirement that an evaluation be done to make sure that someone is going to be better served by going into MSHA if they would qualify for a less expensive plan.
Yeah, although I think, let's see. I mean, it strikes me that MSHA kind of plays the hand they're dealt in terms of resources. And so anything you do to lower the cost, and I understand it's expensive, but when you lower the cost, you raise the cost someplace else. And I don't think we've done a really good job of supplementing. I mean, when was the last time that we did?
2001.
Yeah, so it's almost 10 years. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, that raised another question I was wondering about there. This is kind of a little bit off topic, but there was a comment made that there was some federal grant money you received, and three-quarters of it went to reduce losses that the plans had, and a quarter went to subsidize premiums. Was that part of the parameters of the grant program?
Madam Chair and Ms. Senator Olson, that is exactly right. The grant program is divided into the operations and budget, and they call the, I think the second part of it is a bonus part of the grant program. And state risk pools are allowed to do many things for their consumers with the bonus portion. And we have consistently done a premium subsidy program. Some state risk pools have added more benefits or put on a disease management program. We already have that, so.
Commissioner, did you have more to share with us that you wanted? I think we got through the PowerPoint. I didn't know if you had other information. I know we started asking questions. And
Madam Chair, members, no, I'm here for any questions that folks may have on the high-risk pool.
Okay. So is the official acronym for healthcare reform PPACA?
I think we're going with PAPACA.
PAPACA. Okay. We're doing, what is it, patient? Well, it's not patient, and it's Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. No, we don't go for PPACA, huh? PPACA.
Well, we can try that, Madam Chair, see if it catches on.
So we all know what we're talking about. Senator Olson.
I like Obamacare.
You and the governor, former governor of Alaska, sixth district congresswoman. So any other questions? I really appreciate the information. I think it's helpful, and it strikes me that the department and MCHA are well aware of the opportunity with the federal,
absolutely,
the federal money in the program. And I think some people will think, well, we ought to be the ones administering it. We're still going to have the benefit of the money. Minnesotans will still have the opportunity. And I also sense or hear from you that Deputy Commissioner, that the department is going to be doing outreach as well as MCHA to pull people into that. I worry that $68 million is not per year, is it? Is it till 2014?
That's for the life of the program.
3.5 years.
So when in 2014 does, is it at the end of the year or the middle of the year?
1-1-2014.
1-1-2014, so it's 3.5 years, okay. Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Scheid.
And thank you for coming.
Yeah, I'm sorry to come in late. I was in a conference committee.
No,
so you may have already discussed this, but it's just an issue that I'm trying to figure out how to be able to take advantage of this, the federal high-risk pool, and the difference between MCHA's six months waiting period that creates a barrier for us since we have none in the MCHA program. If we... I've had some conversations with the department about this, and whether or not, if you have a cap on the number of persons that can be in the federal program because we have a limitation in terms of the resources that are coming here, maybe it's 2,000. And we have but we also put a cap on MCHA, so that in this situation where if you hit the cap, the 2,000 people go on to MCHA, then they lose their capacity to be eligible for the federal program because they're now covered by an insurance program. Do we have an alternative, if we create it, to create an uncompensated care pool that allows people to be on a waiting list for the federal program, that those costs that might be incurred that would be otherwise uncompensated if they weren't on an insurance program? Does a concept like that get interpreted as round-ending the law or somehow moving away from what the intent of the law is in terms of grandfathering or pre-existing programs in states?
Senator Sharon, are you asking if there's a way for people within that six-month waiting period to go into the federal program to have some kind of coverage?
No, excuse me, not coverage, because the law requires...
Okay, so you called it uncompensated?
Yeah, an uncompensated care pool, which is not coverage, but some money that would be available to providers who provided the service to cover their costs, but the person's really not covered by an insurance policy.
Okay, Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, so if I understand the concept, you would freeze MCHA at current enrollment. No one else would be eligible. Folks would apply to the federal pool. Folks that didn't get in the federal pool would be placed on a waiting list, but in the meantime, their care would be paid for by a new pool of money. And the question is, would a new pool of money, and coverage is the wrong term, but the compensation for those individuals in this new grouping be treated as credible coverage for purposes of admission to the federal pool? I don't know. We can take a look at that. We'll look at the Public Health Services Act. That's where the definition of credible coverage comes in. And we can certainly float that past HHS to see what they would think about that. I suspect they're not going to give us an answer in 2 weeks. So that's going to be, if they get back to us, it might not be in time for you guys to do something with that legislatively. But we will ask them.
Madam Chair,
Yes,
follow-up to Senator Sharon. The legislature made MCHA the HIPAA alternative to guaranteed issue. So when you say freeze MCHA, you wouldn't be able to freeze it for the HIPAA people. And these are folks that have come off of COBRA through a group plan. They've finished their COBRA, and they can come immediately to MCHA if they have a condition. There's no waiting period if they apply within 63 days. And I'm going to say that probably 10% of our enrollment now are HIPAA folks that come in that way. There's another group called HCTC, which is a group of folks that have lost their jobs. We're talking about the Iron Range, and they've lost their jobs because of federal treaties and federal trade or international trade. They get, the government helps them subsidize their MCHA policy. So there's a couple of groups that need to come to us because there's no other place for them to go. I understand what Senator Sharon's saying, but I'm just saying, I don't think you could do a complete freeze of MCHA because we have to let those groups have immediate coverage.
Okay, Senator Sharon.
The point I'm trying to make, I don't know the methodology, it'd have to be discussed, but it seems to me that we ought to be creative in a solution that allows us to provide a way of being able to pay costs that are crisis costs for people. We have uncompensated care pools in other situations. It allows us to meet the criteria and move people into the federal high-risk pool if it's at all possible and if it's adequately funded, and that we don't undermine our own best interests because we have done the responsible thing in developing MCHA. So I just continually ask this question. I need to understand if such a pool would be, if that language about what is coverage that we have to figure out clearly, so that what we do to allow people to stay uncovered for 6 months so they can be eligible meets the letter of the law, but also keeps an option open for us to let people get to the high-risk pool.
So am I correct to assume that a big consideration on the part of the governor was the fact that what's this going to bring, a little over $20 million a year, the federal program, and the state, what, it's at $130 million, our current MCHA, the deficit is $130 million a year. And this is only going to bring in a little over $20 million a year.
Madam Chair, it's very possible that we actually would get the full, right, $68 million for the 3.5 years, but whether or not it worked out that that was used in clear thirds, I'm not sure.
No, I understand
it,
that.
It's possible we could, you know, use it up all in 1 year, depending on the condition of these folks. And our $130 million of losses, that's now an old number. We're looking at probably $150 million for 2010. So, you know, the costs continue to go up. It's not that that's not fun. But $68 million is not a lot of money. I mean, we pay about $245 million a year on claims. That's, you know, for 27,000 people. So it's really, it's a shame that it's turning out so low on amount of money that the feds are giving a state that's done their best to, you know, get the most people insured. We, you know, have one of the lowest uninsured rates, and it's mind-boggling that you kind of get, you know, tapped and because you've done such a good job. But there are certainly other states, you know, I mentioned Texas and California, that have these huge numbers of uninsureds, and, you know, that's where some of the money might be reallocated. It's possible. That's right.
Which is why we think, Madam Chair, HHS is likely to have the cap enrollment the first year, just so they get a grasp on how sustainable this program is.
Right.
There is no provision in the bill today, the federal bill, for HHS to go back and ask for money. And that was the first thing they told us on these calls, which is don't count for more. So tell us what you can do based on the existing allocation.
Senator Scherr.
Well, and I would just say that there is a reallocation possibility you talked about. And if we had a waiting list, that might help us increase our numbers. If we solve the problem, as we always do, we continue to get dinged for our effective responsiveness. So I'm trying to figure out a way to change those numbers that would influence the formula distribution at the federal level. And then the other thing is the governor's decided that we don't want to administer this at the state level, to leave it to the federal level to administer, if I understood his. And that deadline is passed, so that's a done deal. There isn't anything further that can be done about that.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran, I believe that's correct. Now, the reason I say I believe, if HHS, in the process of going through this, thinks, you know, maybe we want to take another run at convincing those states to try to partner up with us, and comes up with some answers to some of the questions about financial solvency, about cost overruns, about enrollment, about equity, the questions that the states that opted out cited in their concerns. Could they come back and say, in year two of the program, can you reconsider this? That would be my only caveat as to nothing ever being final.
And as I'm reading the letter from Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of HHS, they wanted the letter of intent by April 30th. I mean, that's not necessarily etched in stone, but that's when
HHS plans on administering or running the program by July 1st, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So
okay.
Could they come up with more information between now and then to have some change in their minds? Possibly.
Senator Sheeran.
You might understand that if it's administered at a federal level, that the jobs are not in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran, not necessarily. HHS, for example, could contract with a TPA, a nonprofit in the state of Minnesota, to administer the Minnesota program. And in fact, I've asked them that question, and they've said if a plan is interested, to contact them directly and say, you know, no guarantees, obviously, but my thought would be there would be a little bias to someone who knows our marketplace, has existing network arrangements, et cetera, et cetera. There would be some inertia there. And obviously, there's a certain national plan over in Minnetonka, Edina, that I suspect is talking to HHS.
Money might be an issue, though, it seems to me. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But in terms of as compared to if the state had decided to do this versus what is the fallback now alternative, the federal government doing this, unless a nonprofit were to step forward, do you have any idea how many jobs we're talking about that would have?
Madam Chair, Commissioner. Senator Olson, if we had done it, I don't think we would. If the state of Minnesota had done this, we would have used the existing MTRA program to do that. So I guess I would defer to Ms. Gruber whether or not she would have thought she'd needed additional staff, both there or at the TPA, to administer the 2,000 folks.
Ms. Gruber, do you have any?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, in speaking with Medica, they didn't see the need to increase their staff by very much. You know, we have just three people at the executive office. But it would be Medica that would have to make that judgment. And my guess is it might be one or two, but they certainly didn't see the need to highly increase their staff at all to do this. Because, you know, most of the pieces are in place. It's like setting up a different product for them. That customer service would have to be, you know, re-educated and whatnot. But so I don't think it would have taken very many more staff from the TPA's perspective.
I will say, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that I suspect was part of the decision-making process for some of the states that opted out of the program was they look at their likely pool, and there was a belief that a larger pool administered collectively maybe had some administrative savings, some benefits that they couldn't pull off on their own. The smallest allocation was $8 million for states. That's not a lot of money over 3.5 years. And they were capped at 10% overall of that amount to use for admin. So if any state was going to administer, there was a 10% cap of the allocation for admin costs.
So Madam Chair, Mr. Munson-Ragala, among those other reasons that you talked about earlier, one of the reasons the states opted out then was also the fact that those were states where they would just be getting a relatively small amount of money?
That's my sense, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. That is my sense that some states looked at their likely allocation and thought, we don't have enough here to make a credible pool. So it's just that the cost payoff equation just didn't make sense for them. So, but they thought there was some synergy in having a larger pool. So, for example, this national pool administered by HHS is now reflective of 20 states. That national pool is likely to be larger than our own MCHA pool. That means they can spread out the costs of education administration over a larger group of individuals, which arguably means they can enroll more folks than had each of those individual states chunked up their own slice of the pie.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know whether any of the other states that were in the range of Minnesota as far as the amount of money they were expecting to get, so say $50 million or more, are opting into this federal pool as opposed to doing it themselves?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'll look at the states and where they – HHS gave us a spreadsheet of the allocation, so I'll look for states that were close to us, and I will let you know how many of those states say yes versus no.
Okay.
But I don't know the answer.
Okay.
Deputy Commissioner Munson-Ragala, Ms. Gruber, thank you so much. I don't know if members have any other comments.
Thank you for your interest. We really appreciate
it. Well, no, and obviously we care deeply about this, but Commissioner, I want to thank you because you came yesterday for the joint hearing that we had, and I think you answered some questions yesterday about today, but you came,
always a pleasure,
came back
Madam
today,
Chair.
And it's very, very helpful. It's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
The meeting's adjourned. Thank you. Thank you guys for Senator Dahl and Senator Scogin.
Jail reinsurance
They're
is used
good
to
guys.
So here's what.
We were good guys.
Oh.
Four.